James Corbett is the author of The Corbett Report, a web-based news site the Japan-based Canadian expat describes as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Since its inception in 2007, he's produced thousands of hours of audio and video, uploading regular podcasts and recording several regular online video series for his site and collaborating with GRTV and BoilingFrogsPost.com. His editorials also appear at the weekly e-newsletter, The International Forecaster. Corbett's YouTube videos have garnered millions of views, none more notably than his satirical deconstruction of the official World Trade Center Pentagon attacks in 2001, 9/11, a conspiracy theory. His latest production on the 9/11 theme is 9/11 Suspects. Welcome to the program, James.
Thank you very much for having me on, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course, to have you. And, James, before we explore the geopolitical miasma of the world the day after everything changed, take us back to 9/11/01. Why, James, 9/11 Suspects now, 15 years after the fact?
Well, because, quite frankly, the crimes of 9/11 still are not have not been solved to an adequate degree, we'll put it that way. And, of course, I think that most people will need an explanation, but in case they do, 9/11/2001 still reverberates to us today, not only in the way that it changed the world forever, as we were told so many times in the months preceding those attacks, but also, of course, the deaths and destruction that's been caused in the Middle East as a result of that. And as I pointed out in one of my most recent episodes of the 9/11 Suspect series, there are deaths that are happening right now as a direct result of 9/11/2001, the first responders who are still dying from the cancers and other diseases that they've garnered from the work that they were doing at Ground Zero after they were lied to by U.S. officials about the problems there. So for a myriad of reasons, there are a lot of different aspects of 9/11 that I think are still worth investigating and still worth talking about and still are unfolding like a daily nightmare for many people around the world as a direct result of what happened that day.
Well, yeah, and okay, so your series now, 9/11 Suspects, now you're into the third installment of this. I don't want to be a spoiler here and go further than, you know, what you've done so far. But to begin with, you begin with Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York City at the time. Can you give us a brief thumbnail of why he deserves to be in this pantheon of this rogues gallery?
Well, of course, Giuliani used the events of 9/11 to make his political bones and tried to paint himself as America's mayor because he was, of course, the mayor of New York City on 9/11. But left out of that narrative are the number of troubling aspects of his destruction of the evidence of the crime of 9/11 at the crime scene itself. And this was talked about in a clip that I provided in that video by Eric Lawyer, a firefighter and member of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, who talked about the ways that the actual on-the-books criminal investigation regulations were not just not followed, but were actively discarded in the wake of 9/11, so that standard tests that have to be performed in the wake of any building failure were not performed on Ground Zero in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. And not only that, but the steel that was recovered from the site and shipped away at a vast and mind-boggling speed was then broken down into scrap and shipped off to China to be sold to Bao Steel at a reduced price, by the way, leaving the investigators of the building collapses literally no actual physical evidence to use to put together their reports on what happened to, for example, World Trade Center Building 7. There was no physical evidence left of that. That's a pretty major crime in and of itself, tampering with the crime scene. But beyond that, of course, Mayor Giuliani also said on television on 9/11 to Peter Jennings on ABC News, and I've played the recording in that clip, he actually said that they were warned that the first tower was going to collapse before it collapsed, which, A, should be surprising because officially there was no prior advance knowledge that the collapse was coming, but B, should be infuriating to all of the firefighters and police who died during the collapses who did not get such a warning. So that's a pretty major thing that he's only ever been confronted by, confronted about by citizen journalists, never by mainstream media.
Well, the other thing, I mean, the Building 7 you mentioned, it's sort of the redheaded stepchild of the World Trade Center attacks. A lot of people didn't even know there was a third collapse. It was such a secret. But the Building 7 is specifically of import to Giuliani as well. What's his relationship with Building 7?
In 1996, the New York City the New York City government decided to create a new emergency management center, and instead of using the police building in Manhattan, they decided to create a custom designed $13 million what became known in the media as Giuliani's bunker. And eventually they decided, they looked at a number of different places where they were going to put this. They decided on World Trade Center Building 7, which was a controversial decision at that time because this, of course, was in the wake of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And people were saying, well, if a major, you know, terrorist event happens in New York City, it will probably happen in this area. Do you really want to put the emergency center there? Anyway, they ended up doing that. So they had this state-of-the-art $13 million emergency command center. It had its own ventilation and everything on the 23rd floor of this World Trade Center Building 7. It had showers, and it was a self-contained facility specifically designed for emergency events. On the morning of 9/11/2001, the mayor and the police commander and the fire chief did not go to the 23rd floor, the emergency command center. They were down on Pier 92 because they got this warning that the first World Trade Center tower was going to collapse. So that, again, is a point of contention. And it leads into the story of Barry Jennings, which is right. A whole other story, but basically he was involved in emergency management, and he went to the 23rd floor expecting everyone to be there, found no one was there, abandoned cups of coffee and everything. On his way out of the building, he got caught in an explosion, got caught for hours until the firefighters were able to rescue him before the building eventually collapsed. So there's lots of very strange goings on that morning that tie directly into Giuliani and his reign as mayor.
Yeah, I like that piece with Barry Jennings. He talks about walking into the control center and expecting to see a hive of activity, and what he sees is steaming coffee cups and half-eaten sandwiches and nothing but crickets.
Exactly right, yes. And yes, he ended up going through a remarkable ordeal to try to get out of the building. As he said, the bombs were going off inside the building. And he said when they eventually got rescued by firefighters, he said they were stepping over dead bodies, which is, again, interesting because officially no one died in World Trade Center Building 7. But there you go.
Well, okay. Now, so you mentioned that there are still to this day people that are very sick, the first responders that tried to rescue people after the fact that are dying, that many have died already of cancers of all description. Your second in this rogues gallery is Christine Todd Whitman. Who is she, and what role did she play?
She was the EPA administrator on the day of 9/11. And as such, she was the one that that the media certainly and everyone was turning to for pronouncements on the safety of the air, because of course the blanket of dust that completely blanketed Lower Manhattan in the wake of the destruction of the towers was quite obviously to everyone filled with toxic stew of chemicals, asbestos, benzene, mercury, lead. These were all materials that were known to be in the construction of the towers themselves. So there was a lot of concern, obviously, about the safety of people involved in the cleanup. And as administrator of the EPA, she and the EPA generally issued statement after statement after statement after statement in the days and weeks following the destruction of the towers, to the effect that the air was safe to breathe. And the official line that was usually buried in these reports is that they did recommend respirators for the first responders that were on the pile itself within the designated cleanup area. But outside of that, they said they not only said it was safe, they actually encouraged workers to return to work in Manhattan and discouraged the use of respirators for those workers. So the documents now have come out. We've had a number of declassifications that show the White House was actually editing the EPA's press releases and reports, taking out statements that were cautionary and adding reassuring statements. And we know that Christine Todd Whitman has participated in this. She was sued, along with the EPA, back in 2004 in a class action suit by not only the workers, but the residents of Manhattan and Brooklyn. And that suit went ahead in 2006 when a federal district court judge ruled that the EPA had, in fact, created the danger by issuing these statements and saying that Whitman's reassurances were conscience-shocking, given what the EPA actually knew about the toxic stew of chemicals. But that that lawsuit was quashed a couple of years later by a panel of judges that decided, no, she was a federal employee and thus immune to this type of prosecution. So to this day, she is an unindicted criminal, really, who is responsible for the deaths of not only the hundreds or thousands, I mean, there's no body that's keeping an official estimate of this, but the many people who have already died from these diseases, but many, many, many more who are starting to die. And cancer, again, has actually been scientifically proven. The last cancer study that I know of came out in 2011, finding that the first responders had 19% higher cancer rates than the average population. And that was 5 years ago, just 10 years after 9/11. We're expecting to see a new wave of cancers coming in the years ahead from the various chemicals that these first responders were breathing in.
Well, yes, and this is, as I recall, this was the time George W. Bush was out there, you know, encouraging America to shop their way out of the shock and telling people to go back down to lower Manhattan, go back to work, open up your businesses, etc.
That's exactly right. And, of course, we have to understand that these assurances that were being made and the manipulation was specifically designed to simply calm the public and get them to go back to work as quickly as possible and return things to the normal, despite what the actual evidence in fact said. And now people are literally dying because of that device.
Well, now the first two that you've listed here are fairly well known. They were pretty high profile, but the third is a little less so. Now, this is Philip Zelikow. Who's Philip Zelikow and how does he fit into this big puzzle?
He is a professor of history who has had involvement with government in various aspects over the years. He was actually involved with Condoleezza Rice in the Bush 41 regime, Bush Senior, and he also co-wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice, and he had been part of the transition team to move the Bush administration into the White House after Clinton lost in 2000, or after Clinton left in 2000. And he was also a member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, making it that much more perplexing why he was chosen as somehow the independent truth seeker, I suppose, who was going to come to the bottom of 9/11 in the 9/11 Commission investigation, which Bush finally appointed 441 days after 9/11. Compare that to after Pearl Harbor. I believe it was 1 week later they opened the commission to investigate what happened there. Major commission that you can think of, the Challenger commission, for example, to look into the Challenger disaster. Anything you look at, it's usually 1 week to 1 month after the disaster takes place. This was 441 days later, and only because Bush's arm was politically twisted by the Jersey Girls and other 9/11 victims, family members, who basically forced him into making this commission. He was originally going to choose Henry Kissinger to head the commission. That didn't quite work out so well because, of course, Kissinger has some interesting connections of his own, including to the Bin Laden family. So eventually he was forced to step down. And then Zelikow was appointed as executive director. So he was in charge of everything, choosing the areas of investigation, briefing materials, topics, witnesses, the lines of questions for witnesses, everything involved in the actual running of the investigation. This was the man. And he was deeply, deeply tied in with the Bush officials and with Condoleezza Rice. In fact, phone records have come out since then to show that he was in contact with Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice on a regular basis while running this commission, supposedly investigating people like Condoleezza Rice and Karl Rove and others and their involvement in what happened on 9/11. And as will surprise no one, of course, the 9/11 Commission astutely avoided contentious topics like the destruction of World Trade Center Building 7, amongst many other pieces of problematic material that didn't make it into the report. What did make it into the report was a narrative about how the 9/11 attacks unfolded that was almost completely derived, even in Zelikow's own admission, from torture testimony.
Right.
For example, the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed waterboarded 183 times in a single month. The CIA kidnapped his children and threatened, they said they were going to torture his children with insects. And all of this just insane stuff that was being done to extract this testimony, which formed the basis for the 9/11 Commission narrative of what happened on September 11th. And, oh, the kicker of all of this is that Philip Zelikow isn't just some history professor. He specializes in the creation and management of public myth. And back in 1998, he had written a treatise about public myth and its importance in the creation of the American consciousness, basically. And he said that the last set of public myths that had been created in the wake of the Great Depression and the New Deal were starting to fade. And basically, you know, there was going to be something that would occur in this generation to form a new set. And lo and behold, 3 years later, of course, 9/11 happened, and he was the one appointed to create and manage the public myth of 9/11 and the war on terror.
Well, that's not the only thing that he wrote, though. He also wrote a little piece, and you mentioned this in your video as well, Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger. And I wonder, you know, was this predictive or prescriptive or what? Can you describe a little bit about what this 1998 article written for the Council for Foreign Affairs magazine, Foreign Affairs, by Zelikow was about?
Right. This was from the Council on Foreign Relations. They have a periodical, Foreign Affairs. In November 98, he had an article, as you say, Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger. Not just Philip Zelikow, but his co-authors Ashton Carter and John Deutsch, perennial Washington Beltway insiders. They wrote this article that posited a theoretical event. What if the World Trade Center was destroyed in a terrorist attack? And they wrote about this. They said, like Pearl Harbor, the event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The U.S. might respond with draconian measures, scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. More violence could follow either future terrorist attacks or U.S. counterattacks. And belatedly, Americans would judge their leaders negligent for not addressing terrorism more urgently, which is, I mean, an interesting article. I would suggest people read it for themselves and come to their own conclusions. But while you're reading it, you should read the rest of the November 1998 Foreign Affairs periodical, where not only did they have that prediction of a World Trade Center destroying terrorist event, but there was also an article about America's number one enemy, Osama bin Laden, who, of course, most people in the U.S. maybe vaguely knew a little bit about at that time, but hadn't really. He certainly wasn't a main feature of the news at that time, but the Foreign Affairs was writing about him in connection with this World Trade Center destroying events 3 years before 9/11 happened.
Well, that's amazing. I'd like to have a look at his crystal ball again. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with James Corbett. James is the author of The Corbett Report, a web-based news site the Japan-based Canadian expat describes as, quote, an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Well, to finish on this 9/11 series that you're putting together, how many more do you plan to do, James? How many more rogues are we going to see in this gallery of 9/11 suspects?
I could easily do a dozen, if not two dozen more. But unfortunately, I'm just one human being. So between now and the actual 9/11 anniversary, I'm planning on releasing 6 in total.
Well, and we like to believe that the justice prevails and people get their just desserts. Of the 3 people we've talked about so far, did they get any kind of just desserts? What did their career trajectories look like after this point of time that you chronicle?
Well, Giuliani, of course, is now set to perhaps potentially be appointed as head of Department of Homeland Security if Trump wins the presidency this year, which is a frightening prospect in and of itself. Whitman went on for several years as EPA administrator. She is no longer, but I'm actually not sure what she's doing at the moment. I believe she moved into the private sector. Certainly no repercussions as a result of this. As I say, she managed to avoid being prosecuted. And Philip Zelikow continues with his career. The last I saw, he was giving an online course at Coursera about the history of the world, basically, and how historians do their work. So he, again, continues to be comfortably remunerated for his Washington political connections.
And I saw he was tapped as well by Obama. He was appointed in what was it, 2011, to the President's Intelligence Advisory Board. So, I mean, it doesn't seem to matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat. These technocrats or these intelligence operatives, they seem to be on the inside no matter who is in the White House.
That's exactly right. There is a perennial bureaucracy that it more or less rules from behind the scenes. And as you point out, these characters seem to survive, whether it's left or right, in office. It doesn't seem to really affect their careers very much.
Well, James, now, your site, I mean, I don't want to give people the idea that 9/11 is the only thing that you deal with, although I was listening to some of your interviews on your beginnings, and you say, well, how formative this 9/11 event was. But the Corbett Report, it has a much broader scope than that. Do you want to describe in broad strokes for our listeners what the Corbett Report is about and what you do more generally?
Well, it's about geopolitics and history and science and basically all of the things that I'm interested in, which is quite convenient for me. But it certainly does center around themes of geopolitics and basically how the world is run, how it's ruled. So anything that falls under that very broad rubric. But I also have series, like, for example, I do a monthly series where we explore different pieces of film and literature for their geopolitical significance, things like that. So there's interviews and articles and videos all along those general themes.
Yeah, I've been binging on your offerings online, and you got a whole whack of stuff up at YouTube at your YouTube site, and you also sell DVDs of some of the work you do. Is this your sole income? This is your sole source of income, or do you have a real job or a day job on the side?
It has been my full-time job since 2011. In the first few years of the website, I was just doing it on the side, but eventually I managed to make it a full-time endeavor. And yes, I sell DVDs. I also have subscribers who pay a monthly fee, even $1 a month, to become members of the website. And I'm able to do this full-time.
And able to afford to live in Japan. I know, as a fellow Canadian, you know, a lot of people over here, especially where I'm from on the West Coast, went to Japan in the 1980s, and that to teach English and what have you, and into the 90s as well. You've been there, what, the better part of a decade now?
That's right. In fact, 12 years.
12 years. And, well, what's life like for you there? I mean, do you speak Japanese now? And can you read and write and get around all right, that I imagine, yeah?
Yeah. Well, I speak, read, and write well enough to get around. We'll put it that way. It could always be better. And I'm certainly not fluent yet. But, you know, I'm working on it. Maybe in 30 or 40 years.
Well, James, it's been fascinating to speak with you. And I know that when we first talked or started to correspond about this interview, we were going to talk about Turkey, but we've ended up talking about the 9/11 thing, which is apropos given the calendar. I do hope, though, that we can get together again sometime in the future and talk more fully about the news of the day.
I would be happy to do so.
Well, thanks a lot, James Corbett, for coming on the show tonight then, eh?
Thanks for having me.